Okay, well, I feel I've got a small but very select audience. Just a few words about myself, which I neglected to put in the email to Yasha Bodhi to advertise this. Basically, I think it's about 30 years I've been involved with the West London Centre, an involvement to varying extents. I mean, I came into the movement with a career and a partner and had a family. So my involvement has been, you know, to varying extents, but my life has been greatly enriched in other ways. So I hope I've brought that perspective really to my practice of the Dharma. I am now semi-retired. I'm still doing remunerative work, but I've got a bit more space in my life. Is that enough? Shall I go on? Will you let me know if you can't hear?
Oh yeah, well I'm so close to you.
Because I've got a habit of dropping my voice, so please let me know. All right, now, as you know, the remit of the talk is perfect mindfulness. What I'm intending to do is talk a bit about mindfulness, discuss why it is considered so important by Buddhists. I think it would be pretty difficult to go to a Buddhist center and not hear about mindfulness. And I'm also going to talk a bit about developing mindfulness, and I'm going to talk a bit about the glimpses of insight or awakening that may arise during mindfulness practice. Now, I'll be going on to territory which, by its nature, is non-conceptual. So all I'm going to be doing, non-conceptual, difficult to express in words, some people might even say ineffable, indescribable, inexpressible, but what I'm going to try and do is give some kind of pointers or indicators that you might be heading in the right direction. If you like arrows on a map. Hopefully pointing you in the right direction. Now, a map is but a sort of abstraction of the territory, if you like. And it is very important that we don't mistake the map for the territory. In other words, these pointers we don't mistake for the actual experience of awakening. Right. Now, I was hoping to have my daughter to read the poems and readings, but I think she's stuck in traffic, so I'm going to have to do my best. She could have done it much better than me, I think. So I'm going to start with a poem that I think most of you will have heard before. It's entitled Leisure. It's by W.H. Davies. What is this life if full of care? We have no time to stand and stare. No time to stand beneath the boughs and stare as long as sheep and cows. No time to see when woods we pass where squirrels hide their nuts in grass. No time to see in broad daylight streams full of stars like skies at night. No time to turn at beauty's glance and watch her feet how they can dance. No time to wait till her mouth can enrich that smile her eyes began. A poor life this, if full of care, we have no time to stand and stare. Now, what the poet really means by stare in this instance is really looking at things properly. I find myself sometimes I'm talking to somebody and I'm not listening properly to what they're saying. and not even looking at them properly. And I think a lot of the time, certainly a lot of the time, I am walking around and I'm not really paying proper attention to what is going on. I'm not listening properly, I'm not looking properly. I'm in a sort of habitual state of rather vague awareness. And if you like, we're very often in a state of unmindfulness, and I think this is due to a variety of things. It can be due to forgetfulness or distraction or poor concentration, or Sangharakshita puts it this way in his chapter in Vision and Transformation, that perhaps there's a lack of continuity of purpose in our lives. But for whatever reason, a lot of the time we are rather unmindful. Now, why do Buddhists emphasize this so much, this development of mindfulness? Well, I think what is so important is to develop, if you like, a careful way of examining things, what is going on around us, how things work, and even the workings of our own mind. We need that ability to be really mindful, to look properly at how things happen, how our minds work, and then to start to realize, to see, to awaken to how things really are, if you like, to see into reality, to gain insight into reality. So the way I think of it is that developing mindfulness is about developing insight or awakening. Now I'm going to give you another poem. And it's, you'll all have heard this before, it's Bloody Men by Wendy Cope.
Bloody what?
Bloody Men by Wendy Cope. Bloody men are like bloody buses. You wait for about a year, and as soon as one approaches your stop, two or three others appear. You look at them flashing their indicators, offering you a ride. You're trying to read the destination. You haven't much time to decide. If you make a mistake, there is no turning back. Jump off and you'll stand there and gaze while the cars and the taxis and the lorries go by, and the minutes, the hours and the days. Now, what I think Wendy Cope is doing there is comparing waiting for a bus to finding a boyfriend. And it can seem that way with relationships, that you have a rather barren period, and then, you know, two or three potential boyfriends or girlfriends appear on the scene. And it's a bit like waiting for a bus. You know, if you had this experience waiting for a bus, and you, it almost seems like an hour you're waiting, and then two or three buses come, and you've got to decide, if you're not familiar with the route, you've got to decide quite quickly, is this the right bus for you? Is it going to your destination? And you've got to decide, you know, are you going to pop onto that bus? Are you going to jump onto that one? Are you going to wait for the next one? And it's a bit like that with relationships. But what I'm getting round to, it can appear to be a bit unpredictable and unreliable, arising of insight. I was discussing this recently with some other people, and In my case, it has appeared to me that I've gone months, possibly even years, you know, with not really any apparent shift in my spiritual awakening, if you like. Now, that may or may not be true. It's how it's appeared. And then you have a period when, you know, you have this quite profound feeling that things are really shifting spiritually. And I'm sure you've all had this kind of experience. But it seems to me the arising of insight and awakening can appear to be a very unreliable and unpredictable thing. So, what do we do? We try to lay down conditions that are going to make it more likely. We meditate in a shrine room where perhaps there is an aesthetically pleasing statue of the Buddha. And the Buddha is, of course, the exemplar of someone who achieved enlightenment. And perhaps we have insight burning, and the dispersion of the fragrance represents the generalization of compassion. Perhaps we have candles burning, and the candle flames represent wisdom or seeing into reality. And perhaps we're sitting like we were earlier in a relative quietness, almost silence, and a pleasant temperature, not too warm, not too cold. And perhaps we're sitting on cushions and we've got a nice upright position that we can maintain comfortably, so that we're still alert, but we're relaxed and we're comfortable. So what are we doing? We're trying to create the conditions that hopefully are going to be ideal or at least conducive to the development of mindfulness and the arising of insight. That's how I see it. It's a bit like doing an experiment in a laboratory where you can control the conditions. So what we're doing in a shrine room is controlling the conditions to make them as ideal as we can for the development of mindfulness and the arising of insight. So, what do we do in mindfulness practice? Well, we pay attention to an object. And it could be a visual object, it could be a tanka, or it could be a sound object, it could be a mantra. But what we often do in this tradition is we use the breath, which is really such an ideal object for mindfulness. It shows very subtle variation. And of course it's vital. It's vital for life. And we can develop a very rich kind of appreciation or even fascination with the breath. It really is an ideal object for mindfulness practice. So we pay attention to an object, and we pay a sort of purposeful attention. It's not like the usual rather vague, distracted awareness. It's a more purposeful attention. And we're ideally in the present moment. You know, we leave aside the stories we have about our past, and we leave aside the prediction of the future, and ideally we're in the moment. And we adopt a non-judgmental attitude to what arises in the mind. So whether thoughts are pleasant or unpleasant, we just acknowledge them. And we don't get too analytical. We don't, you know, try and solve big problems on the spot. This is the way I look at it. that somehow, in some mysterious way, problems can sort of resolve in mindfulness practice. But we have this non-judgmental attitude, and as it were, we can see thoughts arise, and we can see them go, and we realize, of course, they're transient like everything else. And we don't have to take ownership of the thoughts. We don't even have to believe the content of the thoughts. We can adopt a much more impersonal, objective look at the content of our thoughts. Okay? And the way I look at it is, if we have this focused attention on an object, it's inevitable that the mental chatter of the mind goes down. It seems to work just inevitably. If you have that focus on an object, the mental chatter goes down and you have a clearer mind. You've got a more malleable mind. You can look at things from different perspectives. You're going to have a more refined consciousness, so you can just see and work with dependent arising. And you may also have positive emotion, which is very, very important. You may have feelings of happiness or joy or metta. And that is really very, very important, because if you get into some of this insight stuff, it can seem a little bit scary, actually. It can seem as if, you know, there is less to grasp. Things you took for granted aren't there any longer. It can seem as if there's less to hold on to. And it's very important to have that positivity to counterbalance that. Okay. And it's said that the stages of access concentration and the first dhyana are the ideal stages for the arising of insight. Now what I'm going to do is look at, as I see it, some aspects of awakening. And this next section, some of you, you know, may find rather challenging, but if you can just stick with it. I've been kind of grappling, if you like, with some of these issues for quite a while, reflecting on them, still reflect on them. I'm not coming as any kind of teacher. I'm really just passing on some of my current thinking about things. And the first aspect is a realization of interconnectedness. And I want to mention some ways in which we can get a glimpse of interconnectedness. Now we see and we hear and we touch and we smell and we think. For instance, I'm looking at that stool. I'm seeing that stool. And the way we normally think about this is that there is a seer, that's me, and there is the act of seeing, which is regarded as a faculty of the seer. And separate from the seer, me, there is that stool. So there's this kind of triadic, three-part way of thinking about it. There's a seer, the act of seeing, and the object that's seen. But if you actually examine things with direct experience, well, what you actually experience is a field of changing colour. Now, do you want to try this for a moment or two? Look around you, and what you actually experience is a changing field of patterns of colour. But our thinking mind comes in and it divides this field into a multitude of objects, so that I start thinking there's a chair, seats, lights, ceiling, and so on. But if you actually apply direct experience, there is a field of changing colour. And there is just the act of seeing. It's the mind that divides things up. It's the thinking mind that divides things up into that triadic separation. So that we begin to believe, you know, there's me, this separate self, and there's an act of seeing. And then outside of me, there is this object, a stool. Okay? So this triad is a product of thought. If you like, it's a mental superimposition. And it gives rise to this idea that there's a separate self and there's a world independent outside. There's a world outside, separate from the self. But what I'm putting forward is, with direct experience, there is only seeing. There is no seer, nothing seen. There is only hearing, no hearer, nothing heard. Only touching, no toucher, nothing touched. Only thinking, no thinker, no thought. There is only perceiving, no perceiver, and nothing perceived. And it's our default sense of things to believe there is an inherent existence in things. It's our default, it seems to be our default way of thinking of things, that there's this self that has an inherent, independent existence. And we develop rather fixed ideas about this self. And some of those fixed ideas can be very damaging, very disabling, because they can be negative. So we might have these rather fixed ideas that, well, actually, I'm not very good, or I'm incomplete, or, you know, I haven't met expectations, or I'm not quite good enough. I think that most of you will have had this to some extent, and it can be very damaging, it can be very disabling, it can really hold you back. But if you start to dismantle this idea of a fixed, separate self, it can be very liberating, and you can have a great sense of psychological spaciousness, so that you're not so disabled by these ideas. And I want to talk now about the belief about an inherent existence in the objects around us. Let's take this chair I'm sitting on. Well, I don't think many of you would argue that, you know, this is a chair, isn't it? It's pretty hard. If I hit that hard enough, I'm going to hurt myself. I can sit on it. Been sitting on it. It's got a back. It's got four legs. So I don't think any of you would really argue about this. That's a chair, isn't it? But say I were to get a lighter and set fire to it, so that the back starts to slowly burn. And eventually the back of that chair is gone. Now the question is that still a chair? It's beginning to look a bit more like a stool, I think. Would you say? You can still sit on it, though I wouldn't like to sit on it if it's on fire. But you know, isn't a chair... Now, say the fire gets pretty hot, the heat gets hot, and one of these legs starts to melt. And what's left topples over. So there are only three legs, and it's toppled over. Well, I think most of you would say that's no longer a chair. It's only got three legs. You can't sit on it. It's toppled over. But the thing is, at what precise point did that stop being a chair? At what precise point did it lose its chairness? Well, I don't think anybody could say. So what I'm putting forward is that that doesn't have any inherent existence as a chair. It hasn't got inherent chairness. And what's more, if we were to look at this with an electron microscope, look at that wood with an electron microscope or the metal, what we would see is mainly space. I've never looked down an electron microscope, so I'm taking this on good authority. You would see mainly space. A bit of a dance of particles, maybe, and energy. And even if you look hard enough at the particles, apparently there's only energy. So what are we left with then? We're left with a kind of subatomic dance of energy. And or a seamless flux. You know, flux, dynamic, transient, changing, and seamless without real boundaries or separation. As Nagarjuna put it, the world has no own nature. Now, Nagarjuna lived in the 2nd century, Common Era. He founded the Madhyamaka school, which clarified the perfection of wisdom sutras. And the most important teaching of the school was shunyata. Shunyata. Lovely word, actually. I love saying that. And the usual translation is emptiness. And it's terribly important to realize what emptiness means in this context. It means lacking inherent or independent existence. And I'm not sure that everybody realizes, but the implication of this teaching, this emptiness teaching, is that everything, without exception, is empty, is lacking inherent existence. So even awareness is empty, even consciousness is empty, even Buddha nature is empty. Emptiness is empty. So everything without exception is lacking inherent existence, is empty. Shunyata, shunyata. And there are sort of arguments for this that I haven't got time to go into. There are sort of arguments to show that even emptiness is empty. And shunyata, I'm covering a lot of ground here, but shunyata is the middle way, perhaps the most important middle way in Buddhism, because there are other middle ways as well. But it is the middle way between nihilism and eternalism. So this shunyata, or emptiness, it's not nihilism, because there is this appearance of things, you know, there is this phenomenal world, this world of phenomena, which we have to respect, you know, which we do respect, which we live in. So it's not nihilism, it's not nothingness, but nor is it eternalism, because if we were really to affirm eternalism, it would mean that the self and things around would never have come into being, would never perish, and could not be influenced or affected by anything, wouldn't be influenced by conditions. It's as if they would be fixed and frozen in place. Now, this teaching is a very subtle teaching, and it requires a lot of realization. And there's, you know, I think I personally am just beginning to, if you like, scrape the surface of this very profound teaching, this emptiness teaching. And according to Nagarjuna, shunyata is not existence, it's not non-existence, it's not both existence and non-existence, and it's not neither existence nor non-existence. Now, this is a formula that comes up, you know, not infrequently. So, shorthand for it is, it's not this, it's not that, it's not both, it's not neither. So I'm putting forward glimpses of shunyata as signs of insight, pointers, if you like, on the map, an arrow on the map. But there are other arrows on the map. And the second one I want to mention is going to be introduced by this reading. Just as the great ocean, O monks, has one taste, the taste of salt, declared the Buddha, even so, O monks, this doctrine and discipline has one taste, the taste of freedom. Now, I think most of you will have heard this before. And I'm putting forward, as another arrow on the map, liberation, feeling of freedom. And it's a freedom from suffering. Now, why do we get suffering? Well, according to the Dharma, it's on the basis of craving. We all know that. If you've any knowledge of the Four Noble Truths and the 12 Nidanas, then you will know that suffering arises from craving. But what does the craving arise from? Well, the craving arises from this mistaken belief that we have a separate self with inherent existence, and there are objects around us with inherent existence that we can crave and try to attract because we think they're pleasant, and other objects we can push away because we believe they are unpleasant or threatening to our egos. Now, another concept or another word I'm going to throw in is rarefication. Which really means treating an abstraction as if it were a concrete, real event. And I'm going through a lot of material pretty quickly, but basically craving relies on rarefication. It depends on an idea that there is a separate self and there are objects with inherent existence that we can crave and try and attract, and others that we regard as averse and we try and push away. But if we get insight into the emptiness teaching, then that craving diminishes and suffering diminishes, and we have a sense of freedom and lightness. And the next arrow on the map I'm going to put forward is compassion. And I see that as really intricately entwined with insight. If you like, two sides of the same coin. Indeed, I would say if you're practicing insight and you aren't developing compassion, you're not practicing correctly. An open heart comes with realization into emptiness. Motivation of compassion makes it easier to realize shunyata. And the more we realize shunyata, the more deeply we feel compassion. And I had a reading, just a very brief one, from Nagarjuna, who I think must have been one of the great minds, in Buddhist history. And this quote is as follows from Nagarjuna. Without doubt, when practitioners have developed their understanding of emptiness, their minds will be devoted to the welfare of others. And the next arrow on the map is joy. Joy. If we get a real sense of joy and a genuine emotion of joy, then again I think we're on the right lines. And you will all have had, periods of joy, albeit sometimes too brief. And I think it is easy to understand how you get this if there is the freedom and compassion I've been talking about. And the next arrow on the map is a sense of mystery, a sense of wonderment or mystery. And I think it's time for another poem. And this is a poem entitled Why Brownlee Left by Paul Muldoon. I've got to watch my voice doesn't get a bit shaky because I love this poem. Why Brownlee left and where he went is a mystery even now. For if a man should have been content, it was him, 2 acres of barley, 1 of potatoes, 4 bullocks, a milker, a slated farmhouse. He was last seen going out to plough on a March morning, bright and early. By noon, Brownlee was famous. They had found all abandoned, with the last rig unbroken. His pair of black horses, like man and wife, shifting their weight from foot to foot and gazing into the future. So I just couldn't resist putting that in because it sort of encapsulates a sense of mystery. But the mystery I'm really talking about is maybe of a more profound nature, and it's just a kind of sense of awe. It's really being awestruck at the unfathomable mystery of everything. And I think we've all had that. We've all had that feeling at times. Just being really awestruck at the mystery of things. And I think if we do get a sense of mystery coming up in meditation, it's very important we don't just immediately grab for an answer. We maintain an openness to the question, if you like. We don't grasp immediately for an answer. And there is a reading from Stephen Batchelor which seems a bit heady, but I think is very good in this context. So this is by Stephen Batchelor. The penetration of this mystery requires that one not foreclose it by substituting an answer, be it a metaphysical proposition or a religious belief. One has to learn how to suspend the habit of reaching for a word or phrase with which to fill the emptiness opened by the question. So it's about maintaining the openness with the question. It's about sitting with the ambiguity, not, you know, immediately reaching for an answer, to foreclose the question prematurely. That's how I see it anyway. And the next, I'm going through these arrows on the map pretty quickly, but the next arrow is beauty, a sense of wonderment and beauty at what's around us. And we've all had this, sometimes a sense of just profound beauty in the world. And even a sense of beauty in things that previously we didn't think were obvious candidates for being beautiful. And it's related to this idea of process and goal. A lot of the time we're very goal-directed, and I'm a real culprit in this respect. You know, I've often got this sense of, you know, what's next? What's next? Where am I going next? You know, what's next that's going to be better than this? Or what could I be doing that's better than this? And sometimes we don't just give ourselves time to be really in the process. It's as if you're on a journey and you don't give yourself time to, you know, look and smell the flowers by the wayside. So it's important to be in the moment and in the process and not always looking for the goal. And I'm going to read another poem, which this is a very personal thing, but encapsulates for me the idea of this of this difference between process and goal. And I'm sure many of you will know it. It's entitled Ithaca, and it's by a poet, C.P. Cavafy. And this is a translation from Greek. So, Ithaca. As you set out for Ithaca, hope the journey is a long one, full of adventure, full of discovery, Laestrygonians and Cyclops, angry Poseidon, don't be afraid of them. You'll never find things like that on your way as long as you keep your thoughts raised high, as long as a rare excitement stirs your spirit and your body. Laestrygonians and Cyclops, wild Poseidon, you won't encounter them unless you bring them along inside your soul, unless your soul sets them up in front of you. Hope the voyage is a long one. May there be many a summer morning when, with what pleasure, what joy, you come into harbour seen for the first time. May you stop at Phoenician trading stations to buy fine things, mother of pearl and coral, amber and ebony, sensual perfume of every kind, as many sensual perfumes as you can. And may you visit many Egyptian cities to gather stores of knowledge from their scholars. Keep Ithaca always in your mind. Arriving there is what you are destined for. But do not hurry the journey at all. Better if it lasts for years, so you are old by the time you reach the island, wealthy with all you have gained on the way, not expecting Ithaca to make you rich. Ithaca gave you the marvellous journey. Without her, you would not have set out. She has nothing left to give you now. And if you find her poor, Ithaca won't have fooled you. Wise as you will have become, so full of experience, you will have understood by then what these Ithacas mean. So, I don't think there's much more to be said, really. It's about Odysseus's journey back home to Ithaca in the Odyssey. And it's about the journey and not being so goal-directed. I'm going to go on to another poem which kind of encapsulates for me, I think there are other things one can take out of this poem, but it encapsulates for me just the beauty in things, even things that didn't obviously represent beauty. And some of you in this centre, I think it's quite a popular poem in this centre, some of you will be very familiar with it, and it's entitled St. Francis and the Sow. The bud stands for all things, even for those things that don't flower. For everything flowers from within of self-blessing. Though sometimes it is necessary to reteach a thing its loveliness, to put a hand on its brow of the flower and retell it in words and in touch it is lovely, until it flowers again from within of self-blessing. As St. Francis put his hand on the creased forehead of the sow and told her in words and in touch blessings of earth on the sow, and the sow began remembering all down her thick length, from the earthen snout all the way through the fodder and slops to the spiritual curl of the tail, from the hard spininess spiked out from the spine down through the great broken heart to the blue milken dreaminess spurting and shuddering from the 14 teeth into the 14 mouths sucking and blowing beneath them, the long perfect loveliness of sow. So I'm going to just sum up very briefly what I've covered, and then just the last reading. So what I've done is I started off by talking about mindfulness, and I discussed briefly why Buddhists regard it as so important. And I talked a bit about how we develop mindfulness, and I've talked a bit how mindfulness practice relates to the development of insight into reality, into awakening. And I've mentioned very tentative signs or pointers or arrows on the map, the map of the territory of awakening. And the first one was the realization of emptiness, or shunyata. Secondly was a sense of liberation from suffering. Thirdly was compassion. Fourthly was joy. Fifthly, a sense of awe, wonder, or mystery. And sixthly, a sense of beauty. So I'm going to finish with the words of the Kevin Spacey character, Lester, in the film American Beauty, which some of you may have seen and which is a bit of a favourite of mine. These are words spoken by Lester right at the end of the film when he's just been shot in the head by Colonel Fitz, I think it was, the neighbour. So I don't know, many of you will have seen this film. So the Kevin Spacey character, Lester, says... I guess I could be pretty pissed off about what happened to me, but it's hard to stay mad when there's so much beauty in the world. Sometimes I feel like I'm seeing it all at once and it's too much. My heart fills up like a balloon that's about to burst. And then I remember to relax and stop trying to hold on to it. And then it flows through me like rain, and I can't feel anything but gratitude for every single moment of my stupid little life. So, yeah.
Well, thank you so much, Mitchell.
Thank you very much.